So my boss has asked me to do a kind of a survey of basic principles of gene regulation, and this is with particular respect to development. So I like to start this discussion with my favorite picture, which shows the state fish of California trying to eat the most famous species of sea urchins, whose genome was just sequenced. And the reason I'm showing it to you is because it reminds me how far we have come since I got into this game. And if you had asked me when I was a graduate student, for example, what's the real difference between those animals? Why do their body plans so different? I would have said this would have been in the late 50s. I would have said, well, their genes are obviously different. But I would have been thinking about it in entirely the wrong way. I would have been thinking that the sea urchin has some kind of purple spine genes and the fish has fin genes and so forth. And that somehow the different structures of those things are made by different sets of genes. And the fact is that it's the opposite. And the apparatus which controls body plan formation in animals is virtually pan-bilaterian in terms of the actors that actually do the work of setting up the pattern from which the body plan is made. There are, of course, specific genes that are particular to each clade, but they're not responsible for the form of development. And the genes that are responsible for the form of development are universally shared between these two guys and us, and they are the genes that encode gene regulatory proteins and signaling factors. That's the genetic basis of the regulatory apparatus. And what's really different is the control systems that determine how these genes are used. So what I want to talk about is the regulatory control systems that determine the usage of particularly regulatory genes, but also all other genes in development. Now, in development, there's a problem that does not exist for bacteria, for example, and doesn't exist for any single-celled organism. And the problem is how to get the right genes on in the right cells at the right time. That's also important. But the spatial gene regulation turns out to be very expensive in regulatory information, and it involves a great deal of complex integration of inputs into the regulatory control system. And that's what we really have to understand. Now, we know, of course, that the regulation of genes in embryonic space is a function that's encoded in the A, C, G's, and T's of the genome, because we know that the parents of this guy look like him and the parents of this guy look like him. And so it's a heritable property of the species as to how development works, which taken down to the microscopic level means it's a heritable property of the genome to how genes are controlled in space. So it's something coded there. It's in the genomic sequence, and it's our job to find out how it works. So in development, spatial gene regulation is a very, very accurate, very, very precise phenomenon. And here, for example, you see a single ring of cells. This is you're looking at the sea urchin, a sea urchin embryo from the bottom, when it's got a few hundred cells in it. Only one single ring of 16 cells expresses that particular regulatory gene, and the pattern then changes later in development. So that means that system that controls that has to prevent it being expressed here, prevent it being expressed here, make it be expressed there, and then change it in time. So that's the problem we're up against. And many genes are used in many different places and times. And the next image I want to show you introduces a very important aspect of gene regulation, which is the modularity of regulatory control, which I'll return to later. This is a Drosophila wing And these positions are the positions of large sensory bristles, which all have particular, species-specific, by the way, locations. And what the image shows is that regulatory genes, indicated by these little black arrows, are controlled by a series of different patches of DNA sequence. And the color coding shows you that that yellow patch, for example, is responsible for just those positions and just these bristle positions later on in development. This is an intermediate stage of the imaginal disc. And this patch controls just that. And if you look at all of the bristles at the end, you would never have believed about 30 years ago that this was controlled in a precise mosaic way, where each one of these patches of DNA sequence receives inputs which define and which exist in the particular locations that those elements are activated. So that's typical. It's not atypical. It's typical, and most genes, as we'll get to in a moment, have multiple regulatory sequences which control them. We call these cis-regulatory modules, and that's the term I'll use for them, or enhancers. So everybody in this room, I'm sure, knows the physical basis of why gene regulation is encoded in the DNA sequence. And the physical basis is that proteins recognize and read the base pair sequence. And this is a space-filling model of a common transcription factor. And it's got consists of two polypeptide chains shown in red and blue. And it's wrapped into the major groove, sort of like a scissors going opposite directions of the DNA. And the reason I'm showing it to you, because it illustrates the intimate connections between the protein and the DNA. And when these connections are properly analyzed, you can see that there are chemical contacts between the protein side chains, there's a different transcription factor, and the specific base pair. So the regulatory proteins read the DNA sequence. And the reason why those proteins bind in that particular place is because there are two aspects that control it. They're present in a given location in the animal or a given cell, and they have the ability to read the sequence in a particular place in the DNA. That's the locus of specificity in gene regulation, basically. So we don't have to worry about the quantitative model. I just want to run over with you what actually happens. So what happens is that the cis-regulatory DNA sequences always bind more than one regulatory protein or transcription factor. And there are two different kinds of binding energies. There are those that relate to the interaction of the protein with the DNA, and there are those that relate to the interaction between the proteins, which is called cooperative interaction. And so the important parameter is whether these sequences are occupied or not by the transcription factors that control them. So if anything is going to happen that these transcription factors mediate, then the sequence has to be occupied. Now, occupancy depends primarily on one parameter, which is the concentration of the transcription factor, given the extent, given its affinity for the particular target site sequences. And transcription factors vary over orders of magnitude in their affinity, and therefore in the concentration that they have to be present in order to bind. Once the, as a generality, once the cis-regulatory module is occupied by the transcription factors which it binds, then it will usually attract cofactors such as this green thing here, and it's actually the cofactors that do the job of interacting physically with the basal transcription apparatus that every gene has. Now, since the cis-regulatory modules, just as you saw here, are often at some distance, these numbers represent kilobases away from the genes. The way that this happens is by DNA looping. And so that is also, and I can return to this later, also something mediated by sequence-specific transcription factors. And so then there are a variety of different kinds of chemical interactions between cofactors bound to the transcription factors and this enormous polyprotein complex, which is the RNA polymerase and perhaps 50 different peptides in that complex, all of which do various things. But they're all, this is not the locus of control because those, that complex is more or less the same in every gene. What's different and where is the locus of control is whether the, is what cis regulatory module is near the gene and whether transcription factors are present in a given time and place in the animal to bind and occupy it. Once that has occurred, then the polymerase, as you know, moves along the DNA and RNA is made. And so, yeah. What? You mean where the, which element?
So the regulatory element, you have your three proteins bound.
Yeah, you mean the cis regulatory module. No, this one is indicated to be at some distance away with a loop of indeterminate distance, bringing it close, so it now gets close as a result of that loop.
Right, but when you just look at the regulatory element here, and start at something.
Yes. Regulatory elements are just as likely to be in an intron, downstream or upstream, anywhere between from one gene to the neighboring gene, in our experience.
But what is it that controls the regulatory element activating one gene, not another one? It might be as close.
Well, your stuff is probably better equipped to answer that question in terms of insulators and so forth, but. In sea urchins, it seems that the location of those elements is usually such that there's a, I mean, sea urchins have a more spread out genome than flies do. So it's, they're about, I guess, about six times bigger genome, or five times bigger genome. And so there will be a series of elements spread out within maybe 20 kilobases. And then there'll be a space, usually, not always, until it gets to the next gene. So, let's talk about, I don't know how much genomics you've been listening to so far, because I just got here an hour ago. But let's talk about what's in the animal genome. These are a sample of the genomes that have been sequenced. This is C. elegans. This is a mosquito, this is Drosophila, this is an ascidian, this is the sea urchin, this is a fish, this is mouse, this is rat, and this is us. And the there are two scales in this diagram. The genome size is the bottom scale is shown in blue. And so you can see that genome sizes vary by quite a bit, and they vary much more than this. This is only a minimal reflection of the real variation among different genomes because the guys who have done the sequencing like to work on smaller size genomes or genomes of animals that are experimentally accessible. So there are many, there are some genomes that are 10 times bigger than this or more. And what the red bars show against the number of genes on the top scale is the number of genes which annotation of the genome indicates is present in those genomes. So the main point is, that there are two main points. One is that there's some kind of minimum number of genes that's probably somewhere between 15 and 20,000 if you want to be an animal. And the second point is that and we have maybe 30 or a little bit more thousand genes as to many other animals. And the second point is that the difference between different forms in the number of genes is very small compared to the difference in the genome. Only, these are log scales, and so only a few percent of the total genome sequence is actually in the genes. Probably I would say, an equal amount or twice as much of the, perhaps, of the genome that's included in the coding regions of genes that specify protein, an equal or larger amount is included in regulatory sequences. And those are don't code for proteins. They are they contain the target sites for transcription factors. And so there's a large amount of regulatory genome. All the rest of the genome, however, which is the vast majority in most genomes, is not sequence dependent. And if you look at the evolutionary rate of change in it, you'll see a basal rate, which varies somewhat in different parts of the genome. But those sequences are allowed to change, and mutations in them, to the extent that we know, make little difference compared to the rate of change or compared to the functional consequences of mutations in either the protein coding or the regulatory sequences. So the a minor fraction of the genome is constrained with respect to alterations in its sequence. Most of it is not, but that doesn't mean that it's useless. It has to be there. It has to be there because it permits folding, it permits proteins to assemble on the DNA that are necessary for gene expression and for a number of other reasons, but it's not sequence is not required. So what I'm really going to be focusing on is the part of the genome that I call the regulatory genome, which is not protein coding, but the sequence of which is required for function. Yeah. Say what? Well, for example, like this. So that, I have another diagram here that show you what I mean. So I'll get right to that point. So here's a typical gene. The exons are shown in blue, and the cis regulatory modules are in red. When those modules function, the DNA loops so as to bring, for example, in this case, 3 is the region immediately adjacent to the start site of the gene, and cis regulatory module 5 is operating in this particular case, then DNA loops that or folds. That's what I'm referring to. When module 1 is working, there's a different fold. When module 2 is working, there's a different fold. And there's a lot of evidence that that's how it works at this point. Now, those loops are mediated by proteins of which only a few are known that also read the cis regulatory DNA sequence and bind there. And then they interact either with similar proteins for which they form homotypic complexes that also bind close to the start site or with other proteins that they can interact with. And both things are known. So looping is a real thing. Yeah. I'm sorry, I can't hear you very well. Say again. Yeah. No. What is known so far is that although many proteins may contribute to it, there are specific dedicated looping proteins. And I didn't have one in this slideshow, but I have a good example of one that I could find for you later if we have time. And so it's a protein that if you add it to the DNA in vitro, this is a homotypic looper, then it binds, wherever it binds, a loop can be formed in vitro. You can prove that's what it does. And there are proteins like this known in Drosophila and in sea urchins and in vertebrates. Now, there may be a zoo of such proteins. They're not very well known. But the ones that are known have specific target sites. They bind, and then the other end of the protein binds another protein, thereby causing a loop. Yeah. So, if you have an intronic, did I draw? Yeah, like number 4. So, these things writhe, and probably in real time, this is not a stable complex. It comes and goes. It comes and goes. It comes and goes. And for most genes, in fact, there's a transcription in animal systems is really pretty slow. So, in a sea urchin, for instance, the maximum rate at which successive RNAs can be produced on a given gene is about once every 5 or 8 seconds, and that's not very fast. Now that's maximum rate. That's when the gene is completely loaded up with polymerase. That's the highest possible rate of initiation. 99% of the genes operate at anywhere between that rate and 1% of that rate. So 1% of that rate means that there's a complex is actually here only once every several minutes, long enough to start the polymerase off, and then it goes away. And so the answer is, and it's the same answer as to how nucleosomes can exist in the chromatin and transcription complexes roll through. Everything reforms and forms constantly. Yeah. Or phosphorylate it, or deacetylate the first histone, or do something to it. Yeah. Yeah. Well, so this is a 1 kilobase. This is a 30 kilobase gene, and that's a 1 kilobase bar, and that is just real life, and you know. That's right. There is. So there are two things that happen. One is that the proteins, the looping proteins, do some of this job, and the other is that there are other kinds of sequences not figured here, which are called insulators, and a variety of other kinds of sequences that appear to attract gloms of proteins that seem to be barriers for folding conformations or for some forms of interaction that are required for loop formation. So you can regard genomes, if you wish, as large domains within which only certain things are permitted. But I'd like to really make the point that what happens to this gene in any given cell depends primarily on whether the transcription factors for this, 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 or this are present or none. And so that's the really important point. Yeah. It doesn't take a long time, it just happens at a long interval. So it doesn't mean that it's a slow process once that thing happens. It means that it's a process that occurs at stochastically with respect to the time from the previous initiation, but it doesn't happen at a high frequency in most genes. So if you look, you can see in the electron microscope polymerases with nascent RNAs on them. If you look at most genes, there'll be one or two polymerases that are being transcribed, that is. There'll be one or two polymerases on them, and only a few genes have a polymerase every 100 base pairs. So the distance between the polymerases indicates the length of time between initiations, because once transcription starts, the polymerase moves at a constant rate down the DNA. Correct. Because the way we know everything about this is from mutating sequences in the DNA. And so when you show that X sequence in a cis regulatory module that controls something, which I'll show you a perfect example of presently, if mutated results in a much lower rate of transcription, and the module in question might be quite far away. There's now completely decisive information that the and let's deal with this question right now. So that that all the things I'm going to talk about begin with interactions by proteins that read DNA sequence, and all things that represent chromatin states or openness of DNA configuration occur downstream of some initial transcription factor DNA interaction. And in all carefully studied specific systems, it's clear the first thing that happens is that a transcription factor enters the system, binds here, and its cofactors may modify the state of the chromatin, which may affect subsequent interactions with other factors, but that is always a downstream biochemical function that follows from the informational event, which is the recognition of the sequence by some transcription factors. And the evidence in this, the causality, is shown. But where the buck stops is at the DNA sequence, because the evidence, the information has to be in the DNA sequence, and the way to demonstrate what happens is by changing the DNA sequence and finding out what the consequence is. And that's how we know everything we know in clean systems. Yeah. I said in clean systems. What?
What about the dirty systems of imprinting when methylation?
Yeah. That's a dirty system, yes. Yeah, but on the other hand, we're still dealing with whole genomes. I mean, like a half a genome, or the maternal or the paternal gene, and this is not the same thing as spatial gene regulation. Yeah. The typical mRNA half-life is 3.5 to 5 hours. Typical, and mRNA half-life, and has been measured, and individual half-lives, of course, vary from some fraction of that to infinity. But mostly, the default half-life is 3.5 to 5 hours, and it depends on what system you're looking at. In syncytial Drosophila, it's much faster than that. It's 20 minutes or 15 minutes or something. In human cells at 37 degrees, it's the default half-life is around 30 minutes also. In bacteria, of course, it's only a few minutes. But yeah. But we don't know much about late development in sea urchins, unfortunately. There's not much done on the adult forms or the post-embryonic forms. So all I can tell you about is the embryonic forms. Between very early, so the only thing I can say about that is that maternal RNAs have a somewhat longer half-life, but not much longer, maybe 6 hours or something in general. But they have to get depackaged before they become functional, that may contribute to that. But throughout, that's a fairly good number. So we measured it years ago for every period up to late development. Okay. So I want to now turn to two other aspects of this. The part C of this diagram shows color-coded individual transcription factor target sites. So a target site for a transcription factor is typically 6 to 10 base pairs long, and it can have some slop in it, which is to say that not all positions must be a certain sequence for the thing to bind. And there's a statistical distribution of binding energies for variants of the target sites. But forgetting that, the sites are short enough and degenerate enough so that they will occur randomly in any DNA sequence, because as I mentioned, most of the sequence, the sequence of most of the DNA is not constrained. And so you can regard it with more or less correctly as a random ACGT sequence if you at least consider the dinucleotide pair frequencies of that region of the genome. So if you do that, you'll find that any given transcription factor that you're interested in will have target sites all over the place. But of course, and just to look at it very crudely, if it's a six base pair target site, for example, like if it were a restriction enzyme, then 1/4 to the 6 would give you the distance of the frequency of occurrence of the site, more or less. And so on that basis, these sites will occur, and they're called orphan sites. They just occur different species all over the place. This is, again, to scale on a 30 kilobase sequence. I think the model was for six base pair sequences. But those sites don't do anything in general. And the ones that do something are do it when they're clustered with one another. And the word module is not just a turn of phrase, it is a real concept. And all regulatory elements that function have multiple inputs, and that means multiple transcription factors bind to them, and they must be, the binding sites must be in some contiguous, must be close to one another. And so typically you can find regulatory modules by finding places where sites you're looking for are close to one another. Practically speaking, if you know what sites you're looking for and you look for a place computationally where they're within, you see those sites within a few hundred base pairs, you will find an active transcriptional regulatory element. Well, they bind their proteins, but this interprotein energy, the cooperative energy, is very important. And so they don't bind nearly as well as what happens when the transcription complex is formed with contiguous transcription factors. So in general, what happens with transcription factor is they swivel more or less by one-dimensional diffusion along the DNA. And they are statistically found in the vicinity of the DNA most of the time. And you can model their distribution by considering that they have a weak affinity for all DNA sequence and a strong affinity for the sites that occur within bona fide enhancers or cis-regulatory modules. Weak and strong, in a typical case, will be 4 or 5 orders of magnitude difference. So the binding energies in a functional transcription complex will be 100,000 times or 10,000 times higher than the affinity for its transient interaction with any other place. Now, for the orphan sites, which of course are small in number compared to all the intervening DNA, it will be higher than that, but it will still be low compared to what happens inside the module. And it's been shown a number of calculations that if it weren't for the fact that transcription factors have an affinity just for DNA in general, it's not sequence specific, none of our regulatory systems would work, because there are not enough molecules of them. If they were distributed freely in the three-dimensional volume of the nucleus, given the affinity that they have to actually find their targets, yeah. Degeneracy what? Well, of course they do produce a weak affinity, but they don't contribute much to the fact that the DNA is sitting, the factors are sitting around the DNA, because there's so few of them compared to DNA. So if you calculate the number of totally nonspecific sites, it's equal number of base pairs in the genome. or let's say a third of that number, if two-thirds are covered with nucleosomes at any given instant in any given nucleus. But that's an enormous number compared to a few hundred, a few thousand orphan sites, or even a million orphan sites, yes. That's what I said, yeah. So I was just, maybe I said it inarticulately, that interprotein cooperative binding energy is very important for making the factor stick in the enhancers or regulatory modules as opposed to elsewhere. No. Those sequences continuously change in evolution, so that if you take a group of animals which the relationship is known, and you can look close, a little farther, a little farther, a little farther, a little farther, then you will find that the different parts of the genome evolve at entirely different rates. So the parts that are inside introns evolve slowly, and the parts that are inside these cis-regulatory modules also evolve slowly, sometimes even more slowly than the protein coding regions, sometimes less, but both evolve slowly compared to all the rest of this. Evolve means change the sequence. Now, sequence change, as you understand, is a function of, like everything, an in rate and an out rate, and the in rate is how often mutations occur, and the out rate is how often they're fixed. And so, every organism has repair machinery in the form of enzymes that crawl along it and fix changes by comparison, by assessing complementarity on the two strands of DNA. But they never do it perfectly, and there are also errors that occur in DNA replication. And so the rate of change is basically the number of fixed alterations. But if they occur within a region where the sequence is functional, then the rate will go down, so because of selection. And so one way of saying that this sequence is not constrained, that this region is not constrained with respect to sequence, is that it displays whatever the maximal rate of sequence divergence is. And that's a clade-wide thing in general. So mammals have a certain rate, and it's a little bit different than the fly rate, and it's a little bit different than other rates that have been measured. But those basal rates are more or less within a small factor of one another. And they're the same across the animal world, within a factor of three or something like that. And that means, and they also vary a little bit in one part of the chromosome as opposed to another, but nonetheless, that's the basal rate, and it's the things that don't move like that you know are doing something just to a first approximation. Now, I'm going to show you in a few minutes that's a powerful tool for finding cis-regulatory modules. It's actually the best one we have. Now, I want to make one other point from this diagram, which is really, if there's one thing that you go away from this morning with, this is the point. And the point is that each cis-regulatory module acts as an information processor, because the transcription factors that come to it bring to it information about the biological environment of that piece of DNA at that point in time and that point in space in the animal. So, for example, a given transcription factor might only be present in a certain cell lineage, or it might only be present if the cell next door is talking to the cell that we're in, or it might only be present at a certain time. So those are biologically important things for development. And the multiple inputs, we can consider these as not only biochemical inputs, but as informational inputs, and they carry different information. They come to the regulatory module, and the regulatory module reads them because it has the sequence to bind them if they're present, and it then processes the information, as I will show you, by doing basically logic operations on this, and then it gives some output to the basal transcription apparatus that says stop or go at a certain rate. But the main point I want to make is that we wouldn't have any such thing as development. Animals wouldn't exist, we wouldn't exist, if it weren't for the regulatory modules of these genes receive biological information and process it in the form of the different transcription factors that they bind. So we look at this not just as a biochemical interaction, like in that space-filling model, but this is really an informational transaction. And to me, that's the most fundamental aspect of how we have to think about gene regulation in terms of informational transactions. And I'm going to expand on that. So, first of all, just in terms of scale, it's always nice to know what the scale of what you're talking about is. There may be 5 to 10 times as many cis-regulatory modules as there are genes, that's to say 5 to 10 per gene, and which means if you add up all the number of genes there are and the number of modules, that there's a very large amount of total sequence, adding them all together, in the genome devoted to cis-regulatory modules, with where the sequence is not free to change at the basal rate. So it's a big system. Yeah.
Can you bear to extrapolate when you say 5 to 10 thousand, you know, probably the vast majority of genes in the genome have nothing to do with development, so they might have completely different number of regulatory elements. But
yeah.
In other words, how sure you are that 5 to 10 thousand type number of genes that you do?
There are a lot of genes are known of all kinds. In fact, I wish we knew more about developmental genes as opposed to genes in general, but a lot of genes have been looked at for medical reasons, for instance, that don't control development, and they're just loaded with cis-regulatory modules. And some of them are actually often enormous genes. They're much bigger than the regulatory genes that I'm speaking of usually. And I've come to the point where if I see a gene with a huge intron, I know there are going to be cis-regulatory modules in that intron. And it's sort of, for a long time we've been wondering why do genes have introns, and nobody really thought about it from this point of view, but large introns always have cis-regulatory modules peppered in them. It's hard to find an example the contrary once it's known. So I think this is a general phenomenon, and one reason why it's even more extreme in many non-developmental genes, for example, genes that, I'll give you a perfect example, genes that are used for cytoskeleton. Okay, so every cell has cytoskeleton. But there isn't just one regulator on the cytoskeletal gene that every time it's needed in every different kind of cell, that one transcription factor or something or set that binds that regulator is called into play. That's not the way it works. But if your cell A, as part of the regulatory state of that cell, will be something that will call in that gene. It will have a special module, though, for running in your eyeballs, and another module for running in your toes, another module for running in your arm muscle. And that's the general way that it's set up, both for regulatory genes and for other genes. And the best evidence for non-developmental genes of that kind is, in fact, for cytoskeletal proteins, which like keratins, for example, which are used in many, many, many different cells. Every place it's used has a different informational address in terms of a different cis-regulatory module. Now, a moment's thought when you start considering gene regulatory networks will illuminate why this is. It would be impossible to build these systems unless it were done that way. Please.
If you think about each cell you will use this oil something, it's about 5,000 cells, or 5,000 genes, sorry. 5,000 cells. And then if you think that the rest of the genes that he's talking about, if you talk about cell-specific proteins, I would argue that they're developmental, because that's a terminal differentiating state. So, you know, in the human, 85% of the genes are developmental. I would argue that they're not developmental. But you know,
yeah.
There's such a different way to think about that. itself, where do you mean that?
Well, we're saying in a way the same thing. If something has to be used in 20 different addresses on the animal, that's development. and even the most universally used things, the more universally used it is, the more like that it is. So it's hard to find a non-developmental gene in terms of space.
What I had in mind is that, you know, several genes have to read spatial information, and the ones which are operating mature cells rarely care about the state.
Oh, but that they're only turned on as the result of a long process of...
But they only need one
drop. Yeah, but look at a mature muscle cell. I mean, a mature muscle cell uses a bunch of muscle proteins, but so does every other mature muscle cell in different points in space. Okay, let me go on to a different point, which is how do we find out what regulatory sequence does? And everything we know depends on one basic experiment, which is the fundamental experiment in regulation molecular biology. And the different ways of doing it in different organisms, but the experiment is you have to have a system in which it's possible to put a gene that you have fiddled with the sequence of it in your laboratory into an egg, get it incorporated in some manner into some nuclei or all nuclei so that it will function according to what it can do, and you can get the readout at some later point in development. And if you can't do that, you can't find out what the regulatory sequence that controls development is. And so that is, and the way that basic experiment is done is basically to take this little piece of DNA, the cis regulatory module, and excise it from the DNA by one method or another, or build it in a DNA synthesis machine, or PCR it out, or do whatever you want to do, and attach it to a reporter that the animal doesn't usually make or doesn't normally make, but which you can see because it's fluorescent, or you can measure because it's an enzyme, or whatever, however you wish to detect it. And then inject it into the egg. These are sea urchin eggs, where this is a particularly easy thing to do, which is why it's become such a great system for regulatory molecular biology. And the eggs are lined up on a plate because they have a negative surface charge, and so you line them up on a positively charged plate. They just stick there, and you just go down the row of eggs with a needle, and here you can see a picoliter or a couple of picoliters of a solution containing a DNA reporter construct being injected into the egg cytoplasm. And in this system, what happens is that the DNA is coated with chromatin proteins, which are in the cytoplasm because the embryo's own nuclei break, the membranes break open every 45 minutes, and the proteins are spilled out into the cytoplasm, and they reform because they all target one another. And so the DNA is taken up, stably incorporated in the chromosome in a random position. We add sperm, the fertilization envelope is raised, the eggs cleave, and the DNA is incorporated, and if you put regulatory instructions to do something into it, it'll work. And that's the basic experiment in Drosophila and sea urchins and mice and so forth. And without that, you can't move. Yes? So in most of the, that's a good question. In most of the constructs, what you do is, most constructs, unless you're particularly interested in studying looping, which can be done, what is done is to take the cis regulatory module and stick it right next to the promoter of the gene. And so that no looping is necessary now. Now, it's possible also to, that's what is done all the time with these things. It's also possible to work in a more natural environment by injecting BACs, which are huge pieces of DNA that are 150 kilobases or 100 kilobases long, that contain the whole genome, the whole gene in all of its spatial glory, and you can, by some now fairly easy technology, play with the sequence of that as well in vitro, and then inject that in. So then if you want to study looping or enhancer function in its natural context, you can do it that way. But most of the constructs that are made by taking a cis-regulatory module from far away and putting it right up against the promoter of the gene with the reporter. So it's not necessary. Well, there is the kind of control that's necessary to make these different loops form, which, as I mentioned, is done probably, and in some cases that we know about, by sequence-specific DNA proteins that have the DNA binding proteins that have the capacity to bind to one another. What signal? By signal, you mean transcription factor? That's what I was saying, yeah, but it works great. Yes. Well, look, if I take different, so here's the case from Drosophila. So this is the gene you're hear from Marty Kreitman about, and Steve probably know that as well. Maybe that. Most famous Drosophila gene? I don't know. So it has cis-regulatory modules that each of which controls expression of one of these stripes in this embryo. And so the experiment shown here is of taking these individual pieces of DNA which are located kilobases away from the start site of the gene, making a construct with the reporter, which is LAC, which is jammed right up against the reporter. And if I take this little fraction of DNA, it gives me stripe 2, which is this one. If I take this piece of DNA, it gives me stripe 3 plus 7. So that shows me those stripes are the natural stripes. These are the natural sequences that control that. So this is, again, a mosaically controlled pattern of overall expression. And it shows me that I can short circuit the requirement for this thing to interact with that, or this to interact with that, by taking it out and physically putting it right next to the basal transcription apparatus, and it works fine. So there's the proof of the pudding. So I didn't hear the question. No. No, it doesn't, it really makes, as far as anyone knows, there hasn't been much study like that, but the distance of these things makes very little, where it's being looked at, it makes very little difference. Now, we have lots of natural experiments which show that the same cis-regulatory module in related organisms can be all the way hell and gone different place than between organisms. And sometimes in an intron in one animal, it's upstream in another. To a first approximation, it doesn't matter where it is. It will find its place, and that it can only work this way.
You make an experiment in the wild type cells, you have some protein which they bind, typically bind 2 to 3.
Binds what?
Well, if you have some kind of adapter protein, if you will, which facilitates the formation of loops in which 2 comes in proximity to 3, that means that if you have something like this, would you have
Well, we could study that question by taking 2 and 3 and sticking them together, doing a deliberately confusing experiment, and then you might find what you said, or you might find that the transcription factor apparatus of 2 occupies the basal the basal promoter much better than the other ones, and so you might see mainly that, but you probably see them both. In most cases, when people have taken cis regulatory modules and stuck them together, you get an additive output, both in Sirtuins and Drosophila. Not invariably, in most cases, you get that.
And there is some extra layer of the formation process which happens by adapter protein.
No. Just remember, the proteins, that's not the case. It's just not the case. So the proteins that bind into because they're at that location in when the gene is there, and different proteins activate the other sequence. And so the question is basically what proteins are in the cell that you're talking about as to whether that thing's going to function. If those proteins load up, then it may be permitted to loop to the basal apparatus. The looping is not the control. I mean, it's whether those proteins are there at the right concentration. Correct. So what I really want to get clear is there's a lot of biochemistry out there. There's a tremendous jungle, a forest of semi-penetrable biochemistry. The control system is basically simple, and it depends primarily on what sees the DNA sequence. And it has to, logically, because that's where the information for the whole system is. And everything happens downstream of that. Yeah, we were discussing that before you came in, but there are insulators and there are domainic separators that affect this in the few cases where this has been studied in large complex loci. Say what? Yeah, I could tell you what some of the speculations about them, but they are not very well known. I think the best studies have been done by Felsenfeld in a human situation, and they have a number of different functions. One of the functions is they affect the states of, they affect chromatin states so that they become downstream domains that are prohibitive for expression as a far downstream function sometimes. Sometimes they cause chromatin supercoiling. The best known cases, or they're alleged to, the best known cases, they seem to interfere with looping. And that's the result of the Felsenfeld analysis. And how they do that may be that they trap the elements, the molecules which were supposed to go from the enhancer to the cis regulatory to the basal transcription apparatus. Instead, they trap it here so it can't get there. And they form a complex that's like another loop, essentially, that's prohibitive. There's a Boolean prohibition of it doing that because it does this instead. And that's the clearest explication. But this is not a very well-known area. We do know that those things are there by mutating them. But I think the clearest case of what they do. I'm not even sure the other things I said are true. They're alleged or suspected about chromatin domains, but I think the evidence for trapping function is good.
What is the longest known functional regulatory element
in humans? About a million base pairs in a muscular dystrophy gene. All of it. Yeah. That's what I think. Now, you don't have to do the experiment right, but if you do it right, you'll see it all. And I'll show you some pretty good cases in just a second. So here's a, just to show how well these things can work, this is a gene from the sea. I just showed you one from Drosophila. That's exquisite specificity, those stripes. Here's a completely different system in the sea urchin. This is a gene that is required for skeletogenesis, and these are the skeletogenic cells in this sea urchin embryo, and you can see the skeleton that's here, this birefringent pair of rods. That's the biomineral skeleton. These are the cells. And the cells are green because into the egg was injected a cis regulatory module that was 400 base pairs long with a green fluorescent protein reporter. But that module is from a gene that's a biomineralization gene. It's a downstream gene that makes the skeletal protein. And the skeleton forms from a syncytial linear combination of these cells, as you can see here. And so all of these cells light up with that green, and there you can see these mineralizing chains. It's completely, absolutely, exquisitely specific, and that's what happens as long as you put the right stuff in the reporter construct. And it doesn't matter where it goes in the DNA because, as I mentioned, both in Drosophila and in sea urchin are the two main systems that we know anything about from a regulatory point of view. In development, we know more about anyway. The insertions are random in the genome. Okay, so that's the basic experiment. Now, once you see that happens, you're in a position to say, okay, I have a piece of DNA that does a developmental regulatory job. It goes anywhere into the genome, and it will work to make the reporter go and be expressed exactly where the gene is expressed. So now I can ask, what is the significance of every A, C, G, and T in that piece of DNA if I want to, and find out how it works. So now I want to talk about this thing and about modularity of these regulatory systems. If you look to see where these downstream muscle regulatory genes, MIF5 and MIF4, are expressed in a mouse, you'll see that they're expressed in every by a blue reporter in virtually all over the body, practically everywhere there's muscles of some kind or other, is either light blue or dark blue. So this gets to the question you were asking, although this is not a non-developmental gene, but it is a gene that's not particular just to red blood cells or just to brain cells or just to eyeball cells, because we have muscles all over our bodies. So here's an analysis that shows on a map of the locus where these two genes are. The genes are shown in black, and these are enormous distances. This is now mammalian. The distances are always larger than in Drosophila or sea urchin. The 140 kilobases in this direction and 5 in that direction from these genes. And these regions, as indicated, are the more or less well-defined regions where cis regulatory modules that control expression in all these different parts of the body are. So for the limb, it's just here. For the hyoid arch is just here, and there's another limb module here. For ventral solenoids, it's here, and so forth, so forth. So if you take each one of those little modules out, you'll get just a piece of the expression, and the whole thing is a combination of all of them, but yet it's controlled in this same mosaic way, the overall expression, as in this example I showed you here. It's exactly the same thing at the opposite end of the animal world. So this is the way these things work. There are many, many modules spread out around the gene. And I just want to make the point again, if you look at a different vertebrate, you'll find all those modules, because all the vertebrates have the same stuff, but the positions are going to be entirely different. And for example, people work on fish, which have very small genomes compared to mice. And the reason they do that is because it's easy to find the modules, because instead of looking for 140 kilobases, you can look for 6 kilobases, and you'll find the same thing. So the distance doesn't matter, it's what's in it that matters. That's exactly what you can do. And now, of course, there's some things that we do that fish don't do, and some things that vice versa. We don't, our fins and scale development is retarded, but those things that we do the same, like for instance, has been done with heart regulatory gene modules and a number of other things. It's a tremendous aid because the spacing doesn't count, and because the whole genome is small, everything's compacted. Here's another great case, and this brings up a further point that I want to make. So this is a gene called SOX. Anyway, it doesn't matter what the gene is, but you're looking now at chicken, mouse, and human, and these are equivalent cis-regulatory modules spread out over what is really a fairly enormous difference. Distance, I don't know what this scale is here, but this is, again, many, many tens of kilobases. And these are the same modules are actually within these amniotes, which are fairly more or less closely related. There's been no change in relative position, but as you can see, the spacing has changed quite a lot within these different animals. So again, there are different enhancers for this gene that are positioned at different places that run in different parts of the body. And the overall pattern, because the gene's used in all of them, is the sum of all of those guys. It will change if you look far enough distant. The amniotes are really very similar to each other. So amniotes diverged from one another about 250 million years ago. In comparison, for example, with things like starfish and sea urchin, which is I'll return to in a later talk to you guys, that they diverged from each other half a billion years ago. So even though you might think they're much more similar than chickens and humans. So we have to consider real time in this as well as clade. The reason why they're in the same position is because scrambling things is often expensive, because in order to get them in a different position, I have to take a piece of DNA out and turn it around or insert it somewhere, and that's often a dangerous activity because something else can get screwed up in the process. So the rate of that kind of thing is lower than the rate of other kinds of sequence change. Now, most of this difference in distance is due to insertion of repetitive elements that may be mobile elements of some kind that may be viral in some cases. In the mouse, they probably are viral. Very. Very understudied. Well, there's a We've seen a few cases where something's different in looking at different sea urchins. Yeah. But as far as flipping is concerned, the best evidence is from experiments, and in a number of vertebrate systems where people have quote-unquote enhancers that have gone to particular lengths to show that the orientation of it this way, that way, doesn't make any difference. Now, of course, if it's far away, it's not going to make that difference. A loop is a loop, and it can be like this or like this. But if it's close together, it always makes a difference. I think that's true, though. I think it's true, and I think the selection is that the processes which would ruin the coherence are frequently dangerous for other reasons. That's the selection. What? The insulator elements that we were talking about before will be between this whole gene and the next gene up. Yeah. Okay. Well, I want to make another point here. Yeah. But that's a hard thing to say. If there's some interesting case and some paleontological evidence that where cell size is related to genome size, roughly speaking, in the animals that we know about. So if you look at a uridial, which has an enormous genome, the cells are enormous. And the reason probably is that cell size is related more directly, and this has been shown, to the number of ribosomal genes. The number of ribosomal genes, which makes good sense because the ribosomal genes make ribosomes, which are needed to stock the cytoplasm with protein synthesis machines. And the number of ribosomal genes scales badly, but scales with genome size. So not nearly as tightly as... So therefore, there's a poor but real relationship between genome size and cell size, a better relationship between number of ribosomal genes and cell size. So anyway, so someone looked at a series of amphibian fossils where you could actually, which are well preserved, you can see the cell boundaries, and if anything, the result has been that the cells have gotten smaller, not larger. So that's a little tiny shred of real-time evidence. Now, you could make a phylogenetic argument just based on genome sizes. If you map it on phylogenetic tree, the genomes are not getting larger. What happens, though, is that in given clades, they get big or they're little, and then they stay that way during the diversification of the clade. So there seem to be changes that happen at the root of a branch of the tree, and all these guys stay that way. Well, I don't know what you mean by group, but within insects, it's more than that. Within fish, it can be enormous. Within amphibians, also. So, if you define a group as a phylum, then what you say is not true. If you define it as a genus, it's always true. What did you say is not true? That what? Like fugu. Yeah. Oh, of course not. Of course not. Well, you mean not every position in the scale of size? Well, actually, that's not true, I don't think. If you look at we made a diagram like this some years ago and took all the known genome sizes, and if you plot it on a log scale for several groups, fish is one of them, you'll find representatives all between those extremes. And it doesn't look... obviously, the distribution, you can't say anything about, because it depends on what people have looked at, which is not a proper sample. But crickets have much bigger genomes than Drosophila does, or honeybees, and zebrafish have much bigger genomes than fugu does, and sharks have even bigger genomes, and they're instances, an amphibia go from about the size of Fugu up to 100 picograms per nucleus, just as two orders of magnitude, and there's an enormous range in there. But I think that was the point I was trying to make in that blue diagram, that although the genome size varies a lot, what's in it that matters to us doesn't vary nearly so much. So, okay, that has to do with this question of space, spacing between things. Anyway, I want to make another point here. So here is one of these modules, and what you're looking at here is a plot that consists of taking the nucleotide sequence of one animal, a mouse, and plotting it against the nucleotide sequence of the other, using a moving window that has some size, I don't remember what it was in this case, and asking for some level of identity within that window. For example, 50 base pairs has to be 80% identical sequence. Maybe that's what it was. Or 10 base pairs, 9 out of 10 have to be identical. When you get that, you put a spot. So that will happen randomly occasionally. But within certain places, you see a tightly, sharply bounded stretch of conserved sequence. And now this conservation is relative, relative to the outside sequence. And that turns out to be an extremely good way of finding cis-regulatory modules, because they are constrained from evolving. Notice that if you look at mouse chicken or human chicken, not surprisingly, you see the same thing. But if you take the wrong comparison and look at human mouse, you don't see anything. Why? For the obvious reason that there hasn't been enough time elapses the divergence of those two to permit the DNA sequence outside the module to become non-alignable at that criterion. So this is a question, not that the sequence inside the cis-regulatory module doesn't change, but the rates are different. So if you choose the right point, you can see these very sharply bounded conserved patches, and they are really the only way we have of estimating a priori what's the limit of a cis-regulatory module. Here's a case in sea urchin. Looks almost exactly the same. And the same kind of, this was a 9 out of 10 base pair window. And this was around a gene, and just like all the others, it happened to have 11 different conserved sequence patches. This gene is used throughout the life cycle. It's a common signal ligand delta. It's a notch ligand. And the two modules shown here are responsible for expression in this case in the mesodermal cells, which is in a torus-like position. Here you're looking at it from the side, or in the skeletogenic cells, which is R11. And each of these modules you can see as a tightly bounded patch of sequence within which there's a very high degree of sequence conservation. Now, if you look far enough away, that goes away. You don't see it anymore. All you see left is the target sites for the individual transcription factor. So in order to get that kind of conservation across the whole module, you have to have sequences that extend beyond just the 6 or 10 base pair sequences with the transcription factors bind. Here's another case. So here's a case where, again from the sea urchin, where there were 17 conserved sequence patches. This was a program that was just comparing the sequence of two species of sea urchins and drawing a line, and this was a 50 base pair, 80% window. And every time you see a thick line like this, it means that you move the window one base pair, you get it again, you get it again, you get it again, you get it again. And so you get a thick line where you can do that a lot of times. And so these are two related sea urchins, and the lines that are not in register represent repetitive sequences that have nothing to do with gene regulation. And these green patches are, like in the chicken mouse case you just saw, in register conserved patches. The exons of the gene are shown in red. So In this case, we took and tested every single one of the conserved sequence patches. And as you can see from the diagram, which is color-coded to this embryo, something like 11 out of 17 of them had caused spatial expression within the domain of genes expressed in this embryo. And the other ones are probably used sometime that we didn't test, which was only the first 3 days of the life cycle. So this is, if you test, do the experiment of taking a random patch of sequence of the same size out of DNA randomly, put it in the reporter, inject it in the egg, then about 3% of the time you'll get something that works. So this is a very powerful way of finding cis-regulatory modules. Say again, please. Yes. Is it what? Well, there are about three different programs out there for doing that. This is one that was developed in our lab, but they all do basically the same thing. What they all do is start with some alignment coordinates, and what most of them do is they align it on the exons of the gene. So now, in the case of these two species, they're about 50 million years apart. So you find and the exons are in approximately the same place except for insertion of some repeats. So sometimes there's a bigger intron sometimes in one or the other. But then what is required for this is a system where the sequence cannot be aligned for most of the DNA, or else you can't see the boundaries of the conserved elements. So it's the same here, and it's the same with these mammals. So you have to look be far enough so that you must find some place to align it on, and since you're interested in the regions around a gene, in practice you have to start with, take the gene that you can align on, and then look outside, and you want it to be at a distance where there's nothing alignable at that criterion at all. If you choose the wrong distance, you get this. You can't see anything. Okay? So if you actually look inside, what are you actually looking at? So here is just one of the patches from that we happen to know a great deal about from this particular gene, which is this patch down here. And this is what actually it looks like. So you can just, the black means similar in the two species, and the gray means not similar. And the transcription factor target sites are indicated in the colored boxes. So you can see that we may not know about all the target sites in there, but there are many long stretches between the target sites that are conserved as well. Outside of that region, you just don't see any place where you can go for any distance and find every nucleotide the same. That's what you actually see. You see a little patch of three or four, but you don't see a place where you could have a 20 base pair window or 10 base pair window and find 9 bases in a row. There just isn't anything here. Yeah. No. I think it's the regions between, and so I don't know if I, and we did an experiment on which I didn't show you. Bring to show you, but I could show you if you want to see it. We did a study of that by taking two species that were so close that you could align the sequence outside the modules. And we did this around 6 or 8 genes where we knew where the cis-regulatory modules were anyway. So now we could compare what's the nature of the sequence outside and what's the nature of the sequence inside the module. And there was a striking result, which is that the occurrence of single nucleotide polymorphisms, which is just random mutations, outside of the target, transcription factor target sites, which we knew, was just the same inside or outside the module. The occurrence of small insertions and deletions, 2 or 5 base pairs, was just the same. But large insertions and deletions were entirely, almost completely forbidden inside the cis-regulatory modules. So that's the reason, the basic reason for what you see. And So you can ask, well, why is that? Well, the reason is that if I were to insert something in here, then the spacing between this target site and this target site would change, and that turns out to be important. So the spacing relations inside the modules is important, and if I were to delete something from it, if I were to say to take a 50 base pair deletions out, well, it's hard to do that in here without taking out some transcription factor target sites. So both insertions and deletions are liable to be deleterious, and the fact is that in those test genes that we looked at, it is the case that indels over 10 base pairs were almost totally prohibited, while they occur frequently outside and cause a lot of the process which results in the sequence not being alignable. Yeah. Between the which? That's what I'm just saying. Well, there are just as many. Okay, so there's some mutations here. And there are mutations here, and there are mutations here. There are these big conserved blocks. There are mutations here. So when we totaled it up, and looked at, and there are mutations in here. There's actually quite a few mutations in there. We found that the rate that subtracting the stuff inside the target site, that the rate of SNPs and small indels was not statistically different from outside. So I think what the computers are seeing when they find these things is actually the result is indel suppression, which has two interesting consequences. It means if you wait long enough, then what you would expect, in fact, does happen. You're going to lose that, because sooner or later, SNPs and small indels are going to catch up and blow the sequence away, and it does. So if I look not at 50 billion years, but at 100 million years or 150 million years, you can't see any of those patches anymore. So from a practical point of view, you can't find cis regulatory modules this way unless you look at the right distance. But also from a practical point of view, this is another approach to finding them. Look for islands of indel suppression. Yes?
What is the color code? Is it light and darker shades?
The intensity of it, just intensity of expression. Yeah. It does go along with it, but indels, microsatellites move very frequently if you look at the microsatellite, but integrated over the whole genome, indels cause at least an equal amount of genomic change per unit time as SNPs, as single nucleotide polymorphisms, and while microsatellites are a much smaller fraction because there just isn't that many of them. So you might find in 100 kilobases, 10 in a sea urchin, 10 little microsatellites, but if you look at two genomes 50 million years apart, a dominant feature that affects every place has been indels. So a lot of the change is just in random sequences indel. Okay, so I want to go to another subject now. I'm just trying to give you a sort of general background of all kinds of different things that are relevant to these matters, beginning with the beginning. And how am I doing on time? Oh, there's a clock, sorry. When am I supposed to quit? Oh, well, then I better quit. Yeah. I wanted to go. I thought I had till 12:30, huh? Yeah. What? Okay. All right, let me talk to you about an example of cis regulatory information processing that's been very well studied. It still may be the best understood developmentally regulated gene, which is people could disagree with, I don't know, which is endo16 that Steve mentioned. So this is a diagram of a sea urchin embryo. The parts of the embryo are the gut, the skeleton, some mesodermal cells, And endo-16 runs primarily in the gut of the embryo and in the cells that will produce the gut, which are color-coded as precursors here. Here's what it looks like in real life. This is an in situ hybridization. It runs in the vegetal plate where the gut comes from. And if you look at the embryo from the bottom, those cells form a torus and runs then throughout the gut, and then it turns off in the foregut and turns off in the hind gut, or continues to run in the midgut. So if you ask yourself, I want to write a computer program to make endo-16 do this, you would right away have to put a certain amount of information into it. What's the lineage of cells, which is called Veg2, that runs it? The ectoderm boundary is the outer boundary here, where it doesn't run. The skeletogenic mesenchyme boundary is the inner boundary that you saw. Then it has to run later on in the invaginating gut or archenteron. Then it has to run in the midgut. And then there are also some temporal amplitude modulations. So there's a certain amount of things you have to take into account. Looking actually at this gene from a point of view of finding out what every interaction that occurs in the cis regulatory module by determining by physical chemistry where every sequence where proteins bind tightly to it, you get this map. And there are 13 different transcription factors indicated by colors. The one above the line bind in unique locations, the one below the lines in multiple locations throughout. And you will also notice, if you look, that these are clustered. So this is a cluster of sites. This is another cluster of sites. And it's another cluster of sites in here. And here is what the sequence in the B and A modules, which tend to be most important, looks like. And so there's a lot of inter-site sequence. Now, I can tell you at this point, these are all the places that proteins bind with any kind of high affinity. So this is just not, this is the space between this cluster of sites and this cluster of sites in A and B modules. So a complete functional analysis was done on this gene by mutating every target site in the whole thing and determining the result on cis regulatory expression constructs quantitatively by measuring the kinetics of the output from the construct and also spatially. But mainly, so we can tell you what every one of these binding things does, in fact. And the first thing to tell you is everyone does something. There is no species of interaction which can be interrupted without having an effect on the output. So if you have, and you would like it to be that way, you would like to say, if there is the statistically unlikely thing that a protein can bind tightly a DNA sequence, then it will have a meaning, and it does. Now, sometimes there are multiple sites for a given factor, and each site doesn't have to be there, but there has to be some that type of site. Here's how it works, just in a block diagram. So early in development, the most proximal module, which is called A, responds to a ubiquitous transcription factor as an activator. But as you saw, it's not expressed, the gene isn't expressed ubiquitously. It's expressed only in the future endoderm. And the reason is that the whole rest of that system consists of docking sites for repressors, some of which keep it off in the ectoderm, some in the inside of that torus, the skeletogenic cells, and so forth. And so it runs initially on a ubiquitous widespread activator with spatially confined repressors. Later on, it totally changes its mode of operation. And by the time the gut forms, the regulation of the gut has had as a consequence the expression of a transcription factor which is gut specific, in fact, mid gut specific. And then it runs on that factor. And when it starts to run on that, it doesn't want to pay any attention to this ubiquitous factor, which lingers for a while. So there's an internal switch that turns off this input, and so these repressors are no longer necessary. And so all that's necessary is what binds here, but it links to the basal transcription apparatus through module A anyway, even though this input isn't there anymore. And there's some proteins required just to cause that linkage. And so the input comes down through module A to the basal transcription apparatus. There's also a temporal regulation. So if you look at the real-time output of the gene, the kinetics of output either of the natural gene or of the cis regulatory constructs, which exactly mimic this, so they do the right thing. What you see is that there are three phases, an initial phase, and then what we call the hump phase, and then after the gene starts to run just in the midgut, there's this tremendous enhanced rate of expression. And by this time, this gene's running very fast. So this is just what I told you before. Early on, from 18 to 24 hours, which is right in the beginning, we have initial ubiquitous activator and spatial repressions. Then the gut-specific activator comes into play. The input from OTX is turned off, and the output continues through module A, so we call hump expression. And then in the end, the ubiquitous activator fades out of the system, and it just runs like gangbusters in this final phase. So if this were true, then I should be able to find a transcription factor appearing late in development that just is expressed in the same place that endo-16 is expressed. So here is endo-16 in the midgut. This is the foregut, this is the hindgut, or looked at from the bottom of the egg, that's what you see. And here is the transcription factor, which does exactly the same thing. That's the factor which is this. And here's an idea of the kind of logic operations that this thing does. So if I were to take just module B and look at its quantitative output by injecting the construct that just has B in a reporter, measuring the amount of reporter over time, I get this curve. If I put just module A, I get this curve. If I look at the total output, I get this red curve, as I showed you before. That was the endogenous gene. This is the construct. Same thing. And you can see this is not the sum of those guys at all. What is it? Well, if you stare at it long enough, you'll see it's a linear amplification of the B output. It doesn't have anything to do with the A output. And in fact, it's a 4.2-fold amplification of the B output, which occurs by some factor that binds ENA. So the implication, that's what first gave us the implication that there must be some way of turning off the input from module A, or else you get some kind of sum. And so there should be a repressor, an internal repressor, which if I mutated its target site, now I would get the sum of B and A. And here's the result of mutating that site. You do get the sum of, you get closer to the sum of B and A. This is A and this is B in another experiment. And there also have to be some way that module A knows that module B is there. And so there are proteins whose target sites are in the DNA, which if I were to mutate them, then module A is ignorant of the fact that module B is there, even though it's still physically there, but there's only a few base pairs are changed. And so the output of the whole system, instead of looking like this, just looks like that of module A. It's with one of those sites mutated. So this is a logically concrete system where we can predict and have predicted the outcome of interfering with every one of those interactions. And we can make a little logic model which says that this is each one of the target sites in module A and module B. And it says what will happen if this site is occupied. And this is the total output goes down here. And what is the function of each of these things can be. It's basically a little analog computation device. And so I give you this, and we can go into it, or you can look at it if you like. Everything I've talked about today, by the way, is in my in the first chapter of my book, Regulatory Genome, if you want to look at it, including a discussion of this. But what I give this to you as a real life illustration of the essential point that I made before, that cis regulatory modules process incident information. They do things to the information, and here you can see it quantitatively, so that the output at the end is a complex function of these inputs, and what they do, of course, depends on the nature of the proteins, which depends on the DNA sequence of the module. So these are hardwired information processing devices that work conditionally, because they work differently depending on what transcription factors they see. And so the heart of the developmental world of animals, in essence, is the information processing cis-regulatory devices. And so in this particular, so I guess I should stop, but I just wanted to make the point that one of the common kinds of logic processing they do is AND logic, so that if what happens in this case is there are multiple inputs, if they're not both present, you get nothing out. Essentially, you get only background out. And here's a case, there's another gene now, where if I take out, by blocking its translation, any one of three inputs, I get only, basically, background is right here. I get nothing compared to normal output. Now I've done another experiment. I'm looking at a cis-regulatory construct, which behaves the same way. If I take out the input, I get nothing. Or if I leave the inputs there but mutate the target sites, I get the same thing. So cis equals trans perturbation. And you can see that all of those guys have to be there, or else you get nothing. This is an AND processor. And it's very common in development. And you can see why it's important, because basically it does spatial control. I think I'll skip that and just go to this. So for instance, here's the case I just showed you. So there might be a stripe of cells that express something this way, a stripe of cells express something this way, but an AND logic processor will just work there. So the take-home lesson is that the design of these cis-regulatory modules determines output from inputs that are never the same as what they see, in either quantitatively or spatially, and it's that information processing at the cis-regulatory module that determines what genes do. And there are other kinds of logic too. This is just a little example of looking at the same logic as NOT logic or logic or AND logic, the way a guy would do if they were doing electronics, or as a in Boolean logic output, or as a biochemistry diagram. They amount to the same thing. So cis-regulatory modules then, and this is where I'll stop, are information processors that determine where genes will be expressed. The most important genes that we'll talk about tomorrow are the genes that encode regulatory molecules themselves, because they determine where gene regulatory molecules will be expressed. And what I really want to talk about tomorrow is how regulatory states are set up. And that is a function of networks of these genes that affect each other. And that's what we'll do tomorrow. So. Yeah. Well, there's also, yeah. You mean continuous? Yeah. I call them bilinear systems because they have Boolean logic operators in them, but they mediate quantitative, they transduce quantitative inputs into some other quantitative output, like you saw in Endo-16, basically. I think all of these information processing system regulatory modules have Boolean components in them. For example, the one that I was showing you that does this, but there has to be a certain rate at which that product is produced, or else it doesn't work. And so there's always some continuous input processing, because transcription factors don't suddenly appear in the world, and the Boolean aspect of it is not that until it reaches a certain threshold, it fails to bind. That's not true. It binds as some exponential function of the concentration, but it's the output of the module that may be thresholded. And so, that's a case of, or it may take a certain output and a certain transcription factor concentration and give you a certain level of output. That's an analog computation. So they're best considered as combinations of, I've emphasized logic processing because people don't think about it very much, but I think it's extremely important. But both things are always there. That's a good question. It's important to remember that both things are always there.
A couple of examples you did show, there seems to be an overall direction in the flow of information, in the sense that the things you turned on first were the most proximal to the gene, and then the ones which are turned on later were more distant.
You mean as far as the cis regulatory modules?
Yeah, well, you just connected it.
I think it's an accident. That's the way it is in Endo 16, all right. There's almost always something important immediately proximal. But, for example, in that case I showed you of the Drosophila gene, lethal scoot and akete, there's an element that's right next to the gene that's actually the last thing to run. It runs in every one of those patches after it's specified. So that's the opposite, and so that's the one that's turned on after specification. We could use only one because they're all now making neurogenic proteins that so they can all respond only one set of inputs. Well, before that, the individual modules have to respond to the local regulatory state in each of those little patches, and so they're all different. So in that case, it's just the opposite.